Hey, what's up? Welcome back to the James Kennedy Podcast. I hope you're all good. I just want to give a quick shout out to everyone that's recently subscribed to the podcast on YouTube in particular, where I recently uploaded a bunch of live interviews out in the streets with people like Jeremy Corbyn and Richard Medhurst and Andrew Feinstein, which is exclusive only to the YouTube channel, so you can see that footage there. But if you're listening to the podcast on Spotify, Apple, or anywhere else, thank you very much for doing so there as well. We appreciate you. I'm not going to waffle on too much at the start of this episode because we got a subject today which is intensely important, and I think it'd be better if we just got straight into it and brought on today's guest. We will be talking about Israel and Palestine, specifically the atrocities that are happening in Gaza right now. We will be talking about direct action and protest and lots of other stuff along the way. So without further ado, strap yourselves in as we welcome on to today's episode of the podcast, the brilliant, the brave, and the wonderful Sarah Wilkinson from Palestine Action. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us, man. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
No, thank you for being here. And before we jump into the broader issues, of which there are many surrounding this subject, for those who don't know, can you tell the listeners, what is Palestine Action?
Okay, so Palestine Action was first established because what was needed, people would protest and people would picket and there'd be vigils and then everybody would go home for tea. So technically what was needed 3 years ago was an action group that didn't go home, was basically prepared to use their bodies as a way of protesting. So to shut down an Israeli arms factory, standing outside with a placard, it does raise public awareness and there is an importance to doing it, but it didn't actually have, it didn't have any results. So in order to shut down the Israeli factories, of which at the time we had 10 when we began, what was needed was really to occupy the factories, was to get people on board who prepared to put their bodies on the line and use and take risks and get the Israeli arms factory Elbit, which is the largest private arms manufacturer owned by the Israelis, into court. Elbit never wanted to go into court because it didn't want to disclose what it was doing behind the scenes. And it's making weaponry, munitions, drone parts, drone engines, parts for Merkava tanks, a whole array of munitions which were being used experimentally to annihilate Palestinians in Gaza and use them as lab rats, if you like, if I excuse the insensitive term. So Palestine Action was initiated originally to properly shut down these Israeli arms factories, not just protest, not just sit outside and go home afterwards, but to actually shut these places down for 3 or 4 days at a time, to go up on the roofs and to disrupt and destroy the company's operations so that it could no longer continue to make weapons. And in doing that, you're also raising awareness, you're getting public support, you're recruiting more people, and effectively you are shutting the factory down. Even if you're not closing it permanently, you are causing it millions in reparation costs. You know, every window that's smashed, it costs Elbit money. Every court case costs Elbit money to take you to court. They have spies that follow you around that cost £200 an hour. All of this comes out of the profits that Elbit are using to manufacture weapons. So it's a really effective way, if people are prepared to make the sacrifice and do some prison time or even, you know, get arrested, to put Elbit in the dock. And that's effectively what Palestine Action does. It gets Elbit into court, and the judges normally find that no matter how much damage has been caused, that it is proportionate because these Israeli arms factories are destroying lives. They're exporting the weapons back into Haifa in Israeli occupied land, and they're using them to murder, maim, torture, and kill and annihilate the Palestinian people. So it's a really effective organization, and in 3 years, This organization has done what no other organization has done, and that is to actually permanently shut 3 Israeli arms factories down, 3 Elbits. So the first one was Oldham, which was it's a massive factory making all sorts of munitions and helicopter parts, and there's a whole array of weaponry. And then the Tamworth was closed recently. The other day they pulled out of Tamworth. So, and the London HQ, which is a very important one, shut down last year So three Israeli arms factories are out of England. It doesn't stop the Israelis from manufacturing weapons on their own soil, but it does stop the British from being complicit. And no other organization has been able to do this. So in 3 years, there's three Israeli arms factories. We've got seven more to shut down. So the job has not been finished yet. And Palestine Action will continue until every single arms factory is shut.
Love it. Love it. Yeah. And that's an amazing track record for an organization that's only been going since 2020. And you've mentioned some of the things that you guys do in order to achieve those results already. But let's dive deeper into that. So what are some of the strategies and tactics that you guys employ in order to achieve the results that you have?
Right. So it's everything from literally the smallest operations, I suppose, are locking on, what we call locking on, which is attaching yourself to fairly impenetrable tubes that block the gates and stop the workers from getting in. So that's the smaller actions, if you like, but you still get arrested from those, and there's still a court case impending afterwards. But then there's occupying the rooftops and actually smashing through the roof and getting into the factory, spraying it red. And the red obviously is symbolic of the blood spilt by these factories. So it's everything from, you know, just disabling the gates, from smashing your way into the car park, just basically anything that will shut down the factory and stop the operations, even if it's only for a day. The rooftop operations, I believe in Oldham, one of them went on for 6 days. I think the day before yesterday, there was an action on Teledyne, which is an American firm. It's not an Elbit, but it's an American weapons factory supplying the fighter jets or fighter jet components straight to the Israeli regime. And they managed to close that down for an entire day. So it is just literally about, ideas are always different. People come along with their own ideas. How about if we drive a vehicle through here, or we smash this, or we hit the wall, or we, you know, there's always new ideas. And the more people that come on board, the more ideas there are, and the more creative people can be. But the main function is to use direct action to shut down the factory and disable it from being able to work. So that costs it an awful lot of money. The workers turn up, they can't get in, they've got to go home. And then you've got the insurance costs, you've got the security costs. Elbit have had to employ numerous security firms and dogs. This all costs money. And the more you're costing it, the more you're disabling it from working, and the more you're creating a situation where police forces have to sort of all converge to shut the road down so that the traffic can't even pass through, you're creating cost. You're creating an expense that has to be covered by the company. And the more you do that, the less it can use its profits.
And I'm guessing that this comes at some significant personal cost to the people doing this as well, though. I'm sure there are some consequences and punishments for people engaging in these activities. Is that right?
I think it depends how you are in court, and it also depends what judge you have. But the point is, I mean, some people have literally sacrificed their liberty, and some people have been bailed, and some people have been acquitted. It all depends about the amount of damage that you cause, and also how you present yourself in court, how Elbit present themselves in court. So every court case is different, but every single court case that happens has a huge amount of supporters outside the court, raising awareness for the passers-by, and the court cases get a lot of press coverage. And Elbit are struggling to justify why. It tries lying that it hasn't got export license, that it's not feeding the Israeli military with weaponry, but all of this can be disclosed in court as being a lie. So Elbit end up not looking great in court. They hide behind screens. They won't let their faces been shown. But the information that they give is often proved to be false. The Crown Prosecutor struggles to say, well, why didn't you try protesting ordinarily? Well, we did. We've done it for years. Why didn't you write a letter to King Charles? We've done it. Why don't you write to your MP? We've done it. We've leafleted. We've done all of that. And there comes a point where you can't just walk up and down a road with a placard anymore. So we've done that for about 20 years. And so we're now forced into a situation. We have to shut these factories down. We have to, because lives are at stake. And any judge hearing that in court is, you know, fairly sympathetic to the idea, well, yeah, you are saving tens of thousands of lives by doing this. So it becomes slightly proportionate, no matter how much damage they cause. But the idea is to create a situation where that building is no longer under the health and safety regulations. They're not able to continue working without a roof or without a water tank or without the air conditioning. So you actually make it impossible for them to go back to work for maybe 2 or 3 weeks. Not only that, the red paint is an indication to anyone who drives past or anyone who walks past something bad is going on here. And people in these sleepy villages, they need to know that they're living next door to an arms factory that has murdered and maimed hundreds of thousands of adults and children in Palestine and is being used to facilitate a genocide.
100%. And it's interesting what you said about the sentiments within the courtroom as well, because I would have assumed that an instrument of the state, such as the courts, would just naturally side with big business by default, rather than these, you know, ragtag of troublesome protesters causing criminal damage, you know, in their eyes. So that's super interesting. And that's not actually always the case. And that by engaging in these activities, which gets you guys then in the courtroom, Elbit have an opportunity to embarrass themselves and expose themselves in that arena as well. So it's kind of like a double whammy effect. And I'm actually quite surprised by that, because I would have thought it would have gone the other way.
Yeah, but I think the thing about activists is that they're on the right side of history. And a judge can recognize that.
Right.
We're not there to hurt an individual or hurt anybody. Even when they had dogs, we made sure that when we were smashing glass on the car park, that we were not doing it in an area that could hurt the dog. So there's elements of this humanitarianism about activism. We're saving lives. We're trying to save lives. We have colleagues, friends, family in Palestine. So there's a personal issue. And I think the judge can see that we're not, you know, hideous criminals that are a danger to society. What we're trying to do is stop the killing of Palestinian people, to stop the killing of Gaza. And that, you know, when you're talking about that in court, it's very difficult. I mean, I have personal experiences. I've lost people in Palestine. It's hard for the judge to dispute that. You know, I have a reason for direct action. I have a reason to stop this Israeli arms factory operating, because one of the drones that this particular factory made actually slaughtered my pen friend, who I'd had for years, even before the days of digital social media. You know, I had been writing to my Palestinian friend for years, and this drone, which was made in Britain, which was the factory that I was doing my direct action outside, was responsible for the killing of an entire family, including a six-month-old baby. She lost all six children. So when you're talking about that in court, the judge can kind of see why you're doing what you're doing. And if I'm locked on outside a gate, I'm really not causing any harm to anybody. But what I am doing is trying to stop this factory from making more weapons that will kill another family of six children. And so it's hard for the judge not to sympathize with that. Whereas Elbit are all about making weapons to kill. I mean, they can't deny that their weapons are being used to kill people. So how do you go into court and say, yeah, we make weapons, we kill people, but it's justified? You can't really justify it. And so it's easier, I think, for the judge to understand the activists, who are always a really nice bunch of people. They're very eloquent. They do well in court. They're likable. They have a lot of supporters in the gallery. Elbit have no supporters. They come and they are quite aggressive. They're trying to justify killing. How do you justify killing? You can't. So they're on the back foot, I think, the minute they're in court. And this is why they've never wanted to be in court. And nobody has got them into court until Palestine Action came along and forced them into a situation where they had to take these activists to court because they had destroyed the building. So it's a really effective way of putting them in the dock and forcing them to answer questions that they're very uncomfortable about.
Beautiful, man. Yeah, and it's really heartening to hear that there is that capacity within the establishment, such as the courts, to have that discourse, you know? And you mentioned already some of the more, you know, mainstream or socially politically acceptable forms of protest and resistance, such as, you know, the marching and the placards and the petitioning and awareness raising. I'd be interested to know what your thoughts are on those forms of protest, as to whether you think that they have a place in change and progress, or whether you think that direct action is ultimately the only way to get shit done.
Both, really. I'm very tempted to say, look, direct action, I think the mantra is gets the job done, and it does. But there are some people who can't do direct action, maybe not just for disability regions, but also they may have family, they don't want to spend time in custody, or they may have a job where they'll lose their job if they do so. So there's room for every form of protest. And if you have a massive placard, if you like, protest going on outside a direct action as well, then that is just as useful. When you have 750,000 people marching through London, taking over the streets of London, that is still effective. When you have petitions that work, not all of them do, that's still effective. And the fact that the pro-Palestinian network has become so huge that there is a job for everyone, no matter where you come from, what your background is, what your experience is, what your age group is. There's even young children going out and protesting and coming out of schools and causing a day strike on schools. It doesn't matter. Everybody has to protest somehow. And then there are some brave individuals who'll put their body on the line and go the whole way. But not everyone can do that. But everybody protesting in every form of manner, whether it's direct action or just the placard protest or the vigil or even just leafleting from door to door, these are all important. And writing to your MP, even lobbying Parliament, there's a place for everyone. And if they're all done at the same time, like we had a direct action last year where there was also a protest and a vigil going on at the same time, it becomes extraordinarily powerful. We had a protest on a bridge, about a kilometre away. We had a protest outside the factory and a direct action going on, which shut the factory down at the same time. And also people writing to their MPs on that day. And also councillors. Local councillors turning up to watch. So when you have everyone out, no matter what they're doing, then, it's empowering. You know, direct action can work on its own. It probably doesn't need anything else outside of it. But when you've got, you know, a whole host of people doing all sorts of different types of protest at the same time, then the government, you know, it has to sit up and it has to listen, you know, and other people learn what's going on. Passers-by, get involved, get recruited, listen to the argument. Everything is successful. I don't think we should, you know, say one thing is better than the other. But I guess maybe I'm contradicting myself, but direct action does actually work. And we can see that in the fact that it shut down three hideous, toxic Israeli arms factories that were being used to destroy lives in their tens and thousands. And these factories have been operating for years and years and years, unbeknown to the public. So now everyone knows where they are. So you get little sporadic protests that people set up on their own. You don't need to organize people so much. It's widely known. And yes, seven factories to go. Everyone should get on board and everyone should join Palestine Action, because there are jobs for everyone inside that organization. You don't have to do the direct action. There's media, there's press, you know, there's PR work, there's organizing, there's all sorts of other jobs that and writing articles and publishing that can be done. So if you don't have the ability to lie on a freezing cold tarmac for 24 hours or climb onto a roof, there are other jobs. And this is the thing about Palestine Action. It's open to everyone. It doesn't discriminate. And so I advise everyone to get on board. You can even just donate if you choose and not do anything else. So yeah, everyone should get involved.
Definitely. Well, I'm going to put all the links in the show notes so that people can click and go straight there. And I'll give them a plug at the end of this episode as well. You mentioned there about the people lobbying their MPs. And I was going to ask, as an intentionally naive question, why is it that our wonderful and conscientious elected representatives are doing literally nothing on this issue?
I think they're so invested in the Israeli regime. They've been invested for absolutely years. They're even invested in the weapons industry. They're also they get paid junkets to go on trips to the occupied Palestine. You know, the Israeli lobby is very powerful. It pays out, if you like, bribes to keep people quiet. And I think people are in power. I mean, some of it is political cowardice, but people in power are scared to lose their careers if they speak out against the Israeli regime. But I think the tide is changing because, you know, the genocide is getting so bad. I mean, 32,000 people slaughtered already. And the UN and, you know, the ICJ, the International Court of Justice, already talking about genocide. Genocide is now being put onto the table. People are starting to recognize it. Eventually, the UK government may not be able to continue defying the will of the people. It may not continue to be able to deliver arms export licenses while the Israelis are murdering British people as well. You know, now with the World Central Kitchen massacre, which I'm not going to use to so people aren't focusing on the Al-Shifa massacre, which is hugely worse. But the point is, now that the Israelis have expanded their operations to killing just about anyone who just happens to be on their soil, including aid workers, you know, it is starting to turn the tide, and politicians eventually might have to swap sides and get on the right side of history, because you know, looking at elections, people aren't wanting anybody in power that supports a genocide, and so the popularity thing. I think David Cameron's come in on the back of this. You know, how can I become popular again? Well, I'll tell you what, I'll start to sound as if I'm supporting Palestine, because that's where the will of the people is. The pro-Palestinian movement is so big now that politicians are struggling to kind of continue their pro-Israeli stance, but that means they'll never be voted in ever again, because people are saying no ceasefire, no vote. So, yeah, it's getting hard for politicians. And obviously the Israeli lobby is having to apply a huge amount of pressure to keep them on side. But eventually, you know, as this genocide accelerates and Gaza is in dire trouble at the moment, whether or not they will continue their pro-Israeli stance for much longer is now debatable. And I think a lot of it has backfired on the Israelis.
100%. Yeah. And I think another thing that is backfiring on the Israelis as well is this shameful and see-through and completely ineffective labeling of anyone who supports Palestine, who opposes genocide, or even vaguely disagrees with or criticizes the actions of the Israeli government as an anti-Semite. I think that is a disgrace, and I think it's a blag that has long run its course now.
Yeah, I think that one's got a bit worn out. I think I'm not like other people that sort of sees it as a medal, because I think, you know, let's lose the word anti-Semite, really. You're talking about racism. And actually, I wouldn't want to say I'm proud to be racist. So when people are saying I'm proud to be an anti-Semite, I think they actually have to unstitch those words, because the word, that's what the word anti-Semite means. But it's just racism and it's hatred towards Jews. So I don't think I want to be proud to be an anti-Semite or proud to be racist. But I think using it as a card, as a sort of get out of jail free card, has unfortunately just been used too often. I mean, they've accused Francesca Albanese, the UN Special Rapporteur, of being an anti-Semite. They accused Antonio Guterres of the United Nations chief, of being anti-Semitic. They've accused Al Jazeera for covering the Palestinian cause on the ground as being anti-Semitic. They accuse UNRWA of being anti-Semitic. There has to be a point where you say, oh my God, you need to stop using this as a way of attack, because it's no longer working. What the Israelis always do is just resort to that. Instead of saying, yeah, okay, we have killed 32,000 people, go, well, they were all Hamas and they're all anti-Semitic. It's kind of not rubbing off on people any longer, and especially with the younger generation. And unfortunately, what's happened is the word anti-Semite has almost become, it's nullified it, it's washed it away. And I think, you know, there is a real good, you know, we don't want to see a rise of racism. We don't want a rise of anti-Semitism or Islamophobia to happen anywhere. But if you keep on using it as a slur to silence officials as well, politicians and officials, people like David Miller, for example, who worked at the Bristol University and won his case. If you keep using it all of the time, eventually what you do is nullify it. And if you nullify it, then when you cry anti-Semitism, nobody listens. And I think that's the danger of it, is that unfortunately, it's an overused term because the Israelis have not been held accountable. They're acting with impunity and they've just shouted anti-Semite at anybody who said, but yeah, but this is a war crime. This is an atrocity. What you've just committed is a massacre. Anti-Semite. And it doesn't, it's just not holding its own any longer. So there is a danger that by nullifying the term, that you increase anti-Semitism by mistake, because people start to ignore it. And I think maybe that's what's happening. So, yeah, everything the Israelis do backfires on them, everything. Even this genocide, which has cost the lives of 32,000 so far, I mean, 14,000 children, I think it may be a little insensitive to say that that is backfiring on them. But it will, because the popularity war has been lost. I can't find anybody that would openly support the Israeli regime at the moment. Even those that do are remaining silent, and those that used to have come over to the Palestinian cause.
Yeah, they're losing the propaganda war on all fronts. I mean, what is happening is just so extreme and so obscene and so horrific on a daily basis that even those people who were staunch supporters of Israel's right to exist and defend itself, even those guys are like, wow, man, this is fucking way, way, way too much. This is a literal genocide happening on our doorstep and in our times. And I don't think anybody needs me or anyone to remind them of exactly what's at stake here or what's happening, because it is literally in our face all day, every day, just the sheer scale of the horror that is happening in Gaza right now. But for anyone listening who needs a reminder as to why what you guys are doing is so necessary and so important, could you tell them why it is that you do what you do and why it is necessary and what you think lies ahead in this particular struggle?
Actually, people haven't quite, even people on side aren't really waking up to what's happening in Gaza. Why all of these campaigns? And there's multiple campaigns and they're all having an effect and they're all very equally important. However, what's happening at the moment is the Israelis have built what's called the Netzarim Corridor, which has cut north Gaza from South Gaza. So instead of there being a central Gaza, it's only south and north now. And the Gaza pier, or what we've been calling the Gaza death port, which has nothing to do with humanitarian aid, but will allow Israeli ships to come in with not just munitions for the Israeli regime to continue its genocide, but also building materials for the Israelis to start building their waterfront posh properties on Palestinian land. The Netzarim corridor effectively cuts off the north of Gaza entirely. So you're talking of no humanitarian aid trucks can get across. The people in the north are already in a state of famine, but an Israeli engineered famine. Somebody keeps telling me to always remember to say this is a man-made famine. But now we are reliant on airdrops in North Gaza. There is no route through to feed the people. And there's 750,000 at top, 600,000 is the official figures that are still in North Gaza. And they are completely segregated from South Gaza. Now, what's happening in Rafah is we think that eventually they are going to close the Rafah crossing. So all of the campaigns talking about trying to get food in and out of Rafah, they're finished. So the people in Rafah will be pushed towards probably Deir Abella, which they're already bombing, and then they'll be forced towards this port. That will be the only access in and out of Gaza. And what people aren't waking up to is that North Gaza is probably already lost. I don't mean to be pessimistic, but there's no way to get anyone in or out of North Gaza. And these people have been eating grass for actually some other horrific things like dead rodents, weeds that aren't really palatable, but also animal fodder that is literally poisoning babies and children off. And people are saying, well, you know, how come the children always die first? The children always die first in a famine. This is how it acts, because adults just probably can eat things that children can't. So we've got no baby formula going into North Gaza. We've got no food. They're eating grass. The only thing they have is the airdrops, which have not always been successful, as we know. But when you're reliant on airdrops, we're now reliant on the Jordanian Royal Air Force to keep doing them. Now, the Israelis are starting to ban other countries taking part in the airdrops. We have over 600,000 people in North Gaza that actually are going to starve to death. And there is no way of reaching them because of this Nazarim corridor. So I really want people to keep an eye on, obviously the beach is gone. The beach will be a military barrack. So if you consider the fishing industry, that's gone, that's finished. The harbour is in the north. Al-Shifa Hospital, where all the massacres took place, is in the north. They're all past this tank belt. So Gaza is in severe trouble at the moment. And people really need to focus on how we get rid of this humanitarian aid port, which isn't a humanitarian aid port. It could be used to forcibly exile Palestinians permanently into other foreign countries who may or may not take them. I can imagine hundreds of thousands of Palestinians floating around in the ocean, many of them drowning because no one's going to take them in. That could be the next situation. Or they will use it for a huge massacre where everybody is forced at gunpoint out of Rafah into the beach area where this port is, and then they will be killed because they will be seen running towards the Israeli troops and they'll massacre them all. The dangers of the Netzarim corridor preventing Palestinians from reaching family and getting food into the north are huge, and we really want people to take note. We are hoping that the massacres that the Israelis have committed, I mean, 59 people were killed last night alone. I think there was 117 the day before. So every day it's between 70 and 100 people on average. The dangers now are we need the government to put in an arms embargo, a ceasefire with a complete withdrawal of Israeli troops. Because if a ceasefire happens without the withdrawal of Israeli troops, you've still got the Netzarim corridor blocking humanitarian aid getting to the Palestinians in the north. So we're still going to have 600,000 people die of starvation. And we won't be able to do anything about it. So, yeah, there's sort of multiple dangers. Rafah, we think, is closing permanently. That means Egypt is no longer in the picture. Even if people want to run a campaign to force Sisi to open the Rafah border, it makes no difference. The Israelis are going to probably detonate or dismantle it. Rafah border is closing. The tanks are going to come and take over the Philadelphia corridor, which separates Gaza and Egypt, which means the North Sinai is also in danger. So, yeah, the Gaza is in trouble. What we need is a ceasefire, two-way arms embargo, sanctions, and we need the ceasefire to have the conditions that the Israeli troops withdraw. And if we don't have that, then Gaza is finished.
Oh, man. I mean, I don't even have any words at this point. You know what I mean? There's nothing anyone can say that hasn't been said. And there's nothing that can be said that could truly express the scale of horror that is happening in Gaza as we speak right now. It truly is the stuff of nightmares. And it could all be stopped if there was any spine in any of our politicians that could put any kind of pressure, political, financial, militaristic, on Israel. It could end tomorrow. And this shit keeps me up at night, man. Honestly, I can't fucking believe I'm witnessing this in my lifetime. For anyone who's incensed by what they've heard today, or is incensed by this cause generally, who wants to get involved and support Palestine Action, please, the first port of call should be to go to palestineaction.org, where you can join and sign up, or you can donate and help the guys that way, or you can get assets to share and resources to learn from as well. For in-the-minute updates as they happen daily, please go and follow the guys at pal_action on Twitter, and it's the same address on Instagram and TikTok as well. Please give them a follow and support them there and help to amplify everything that they're sharing on their pages. And as I said, there'll be a link in the show notes as well so that you can go straight there and click. Is there anywhere else you'd like people to go and check out and follow and support?
Yeah, not wanting to sort of plug myself, but I'm at S. Wilkinson, BC, and I basically, as a social media influencer, it's my job to tweet every single day. So there's a wide range of news from everything, from every aspect, really. And I try and do about 30 to 40 posts per day. And it's horrific, actually. I'm sorry, my account is doom and gloom because I'm reporting on the deaths, the massacres, Palestinian prisoners, the torture, the Palestinian Women Too movement, which is about the rape of Palestinian women, not just in custody, but those abducted. Sorry, my account is doom and gloom, but it's news. And I try and cover everything with a press release. So occasionally I might drop in an opinionated tweet, but I do try and keep it to the press releases that are coming out. It will cover what Biden is doing and saying, what Netanyahu is doing and saying. So literally every single day. I mean, I think I did 50 posts yesterday.
Wow.
So and that is a daily thing. I don't get a day off. It's 24/7. So and then also there's the Twitter Spaces. We run Twitter Spaces to give Palestinians in Gaza a chance to speak and a chance to say from their perspective what's happening. And so you hear tales of starvation. One man buried 39 members of his family. These are not easy places. There's not easy spaces to have to listen to, but you get it from a Palestinian on the ground. So it's not just us whiteys talking about the Palestinian cause. We're in contact with several what have become amateur journalists because the journalists are gone or they've been killed or they've been banned. So we're listening to actual Palestinians who are trying to survive, but then they know that the next day they've got to survive that survival. And so you hear it directly from them. So, yeah, another account to follow would be Leila Hatoum, which is at Leila H1. NY Plaid is doing the research on the Netzarim corridor, and he's at NYPLAID, NY Plaid. And my colleague Shamin Suleiman, at Shamin Suleiman, that should come up straight away. All these people on Twitter are trying to cover what's going on in Palestine. Oh, and there's one other thing. There's the No Thanks boycott. A man called Ahmed Bashbash, who's also Palestinian, he has created an app which you download for free, take it in the shop, scan everything you buy. It either goes yes or it is a big red screen and it says no, it's an Israeli product, don't buy this. So the No Thanks app, which, and you literally just put No Thanks boycott and it will come up. And that's on available for both Android and also for Apple phones. And it's absolutely a brilliant app. Honestly, it changes your diet because I've been buying a product thinking, yeah, no, guilt-free. This isn't a Israeli product, only to find that all these years I've been buying an Israeli product. So I've had to change. And I only have a little shop. So I've actually had to change my diet to fit in with this app. But yeah, it's brilliant. And everybody should get it. It's free. You don't have to pay for it.
That's
so
amazing.
The No Thanks app, which is green, you can't miss it. That's another thing to get on board because then we're boycotting the Israeli regime in our thousands and millions as well. So yeah, whole multitude of people to follow there. And sorry about that.
Amazing. No, plug away. I'm going to put a link to the app as well because I have heard of the app and then I've got so much content coming at me, I forgot to check it out. So I've made a note. I'll put the link to the show notes for that as well. Sarah, thank you so much. Before we go, I just want to ask you a personal question because you did mention there that you're putting out a lot of very, you know, horrific content at such a mass scale because of what you're doing for a living and what you're involved in personally as well. How do you keep yourself, how do you check your own mental health and keep yourself okay during all of this?
I'm not doing very well at the moment. I've lost some quite close friends recently. It's very hard to grieve because if you're grieving, you're taking away the pain that belongs to the Palestinians. And so I feel that I can't talk to another Palestinian about it because, you know, they're burying their children. They're not going to want to hear about me losing a friend. So I've actually found it very difficult. I've even been on a retreat to try and get to a place where I could move on. It's hard. So I am struggling a little bit. I'm losing Gaza. I'm losing the people that I've worked with for years, and I'm watching it, and I'm watching my government do nothing. I'm watching my government abstain from ceasefire resolutions or vote against them. And the anger and the fury is kind of hard. You have to have a very strong network, which I do, and you have to be able to ring people and say, right, I'm not doing okay today. I've just lost another journalist, and I can't move on. And I have to keep tweeting while I'm doing that. I have to keep posting as if it hasn't happened. And, you know, there are bad days and there are good days, but I still have to do it 24/7 because that's now how I see. I'm working for Palestine. That is my job, and it's become a full-time job. But, yeah, dealing with the grief and bereavement, you have to kind of keep it quiet when you're around Palestinians. Because it's their grief. Look, they've been occupied. They've had everything stolen from them. They've had their food and their culture stolen. I'm not going to steal their grief. But at the same time, I have to find someone who's prepared to listen. And we're all in the same boat. This is the thing. Whoever you speak to, they've also lost somebody the day before. Or they've lost the same person because we're all connected. It's really difficult. It's getting harder. And I know that there's a lot of people with secondary PTSD from the genocide. A lot of people have actually closed their accounts just to have like a proper week's break. How I see it is we don't have time to have a week's break. Really, I should take some time out, but I can't because every day there's another massacre and it has to be reported. And that's just my job. And if the Palestinian can face bullets and bombs every single day, live on a diet of grass and bury their children in the middle of the road because there's no land left, then I can deal with a little bit of PTSD.
Sarah, you're a hero for what you're doing. We appreciate you. We respect you. And we hope that you look after yourself as well, because if you break, that's one less hero on the front lines, isn't it? You know, and this cause needs you. So thank you for everything you're doing. Thank you for being with us today. Stay safe, stay strong, and free Palestine.
Thank you. Free Palestine.
Oh, man, that was it's a tough listen, isn't it? You know what I mean? It's like we all know what's happening. We see it, you know, on social media. We see it on the news. It's impossible to avoid this issue right now, and neither should we. But it's still, there's just no way you can compute or process what is happening. You know what I mean? It's just... it is easily the worst thing I've witnessed in my entire life. It's the worst global event that I've witnessed. And I'm just witnessing it. You know, I'm just sitting here talking about it on a fucking podcast. And it just keeps me up at night. I can't believe that I'm seeing this shit. That this is happening and then it's totally okay. That the world leaders are just chin-wagging about it. You know, are back and forth on some fucking technicality. Rather than just doing anything and whatever they can to enforce an immediate ceasefire. This is madness. This is literal psychopathic madness. You cannot just get away with this. I didn't think you could, but apparently you can. It disturbs me deeply, man. It really, really does. None of our fucking leaders can ever claim to have a moral high ground or a conscience or a spine or values or principles or things that they believe in ever again. If you can't call for a ceasefire in Gaza with everything that's happening right now, you, my friend, are not fit for office. You're probably not fit to be walking around unsupervised in society. But look, I'm not going to be able to say it any better than Sarah did, you know, and she's out there doing it, making a difference, whereas I'm just chatting shit on the podcast. So I'm going to bow out gracefully because this shit really, really gets under my fucking skin. I'm going to plug the links one more time. Palestine Action, please support everything they're doing. These are brave people putting their lives and their safety and their careers and their personal lives on the line. They deserve all of our support. Please go to palestineaction.org. They are on Twitter at pal_action. The same on Instagram and TikTok. They are on Facebook at Palestine Action Network. Please go and join all of their pages. Get involved. And at the very least, please share their updates and their campaigns to help normalize this resistance and to show that you support them. If you want to get directly involved, there will be a way that you can contact them through the website. You can also donate there as well if you want to help and support that way. As Sarah mentioned, she can be found on Twitter at SWilkinsonBC. She's got a ton of followers on there and she shares a ton of content every day, which gives you up-to-date, in-the-minute updates on this issue. Please go and show her some love as well. And thanks to you for listening. As always, you know, it seems shallow to be plugging a fucking podcast at times like these, but if you could give me a subscribe and a follow and a star rating and a comment and all that sort of stuff, that would really help me out as well. If you're listening to this on YouTube, please jump into the comments and share your views on all of these issues, because, you know, we'd always love to hear what you guys think. And I'll be back next week with another episode with another brilliant guest. In the meantime, as always, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and free Palestine.